My name is Robert Hookman. This panel is called Why We Should Ignore Users, and today we're going to discuss the merits of user research, things like personas and scenarios, things that are common to user-centered design processes and goal-directed design processes. And we're going to get into a bit of a debate to find out whether this is actually a valid approach or not, or whether maybe we need a new approach. And I'm actually the only one on the panel who's going to be passionately fighting for the new approach. So, and that gentleman back there is holding up his green card already. I'm going to tell you about the green cards, the green and red cards that are sitting on all of your chairs. As we, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to each give 6.5 minute long presentations to sort of make our case about our different approaches. But after that, once we move into the open discussion, we're going to take questions from the audience and from Christina, our moderator over on the end of the table. And those red and green cards are for whether or not you agree or disagree with us. So feel free to just pipe up at any time and let us know what you think.
So red is disagree and green is agree.
Right. If that wasn't obvious, if there's anybody in the audience that's colorblind, we deeply apologize. I just want to have everyone introduce themselves first. I'm Robert Hookman Jr. And I'll come back to that in a minute.
You want me to say where I come from?
Shoot.
Okay, I'm Sarah Bloomer. I'm with Sarah Bloomer and Co. I've been working in user-centered design for about 20 years, and what you'll hear me talk mostly about is a business that I set up in Australia for 10 years, a consulting business, and I'll talk a lot about my experience doing that. I now live in America again, doing consulting.
My name is Mark Schrod. I have been a consultant for most of my career. My father is thrilled I finally found a job this summer at AOL.
My name is Christina Woodkey. I am founder, CEO of Cucina Media and publisher of Boxes and Arrows. And previously, I was senior director of design at Search and Marketplace. So I've lived through Yahoo, which means doing every kind of user testing ever invented, from A-B testing to eye tracking to everything, to being a startup where I go up to my users and say, hey, will you talk to me for 5 minutes, please, please? So I'm really curious to see how these guys explain their points of view, and hopefully I can adapt some of it for my startup.
Excellent. Yeah, actually that's the reason we invited Christina to be the moderator of this panel is because she actually has this problem all the time. She's not sure which approach to take, so she's looking for genuine answers herself, so hopefully we'll be able to help her out, and hopefully we'll be able to give you guys some new ideas and have some fun along the way. So, first up, as I said, we're going to do some short presentations just to make our case. First one is going to be with Mark Schrott.
Where did my computer go? Thanks, Robert. I'm going to play kind of the setup guy this morning. As I said, I'm in my first actual job in probably 20 years. I joined AOL this summer, helping them in the marketplace division shift some things from traditional waterfall and some fairly static processes to something that's a little bit more dynamic, a little bit more in tune with our users. As you may know, previously we really didn't have to pay attention to our users. I am a proponent of UCD as it stands now. I think it's a great system to get started with. I think it's a good baseline, and it's very good for what most of us are trying to do, which is to build richer interactions, to build things that are more adept or more appropriate for our users. And my slide is way slow. I've run out of things to say for this. My background, I have about 20 years in HCI. I've been hanging around design shops since I was about 14, mostly doing consulting for the last 20 or so years. In the early 90s, I adapted a systems approach to design, thinking about context. I've also worked extensively in branding, marketing, research, and I do a lot of business strategy as well. So I come at this from a lot of different angles, and I think about the stakeholders a lot. Most of us, when we think about interaction, think in terms of a very specific set of circumstances. We think about a person and typically an application. What I'm going to talk about goes quite a bit beyond that. It applies to all sorts of things. I think designers that do brochures, designers that do trade show booths can all benefit from thinking about context, how the product or how what you're doing is actually going to be used. In a simple interaction model, obviously you're going to have the person, the user, consumer, whatever you want to call them. You're going to have the technology that you're going to be working with, other users, you're going to have the environment, lots of influences. There's more than that, just that one single set of interactions that need to be thought about, need to be concerned with. This slide gives you a little bit of an idea of how I think about these situations. Interaction rarely happens directly with a computer. There's almost always somebody else at the other end of the interaction, usually multiple groups, particularly in social networking, things like that. Client-server interactions, all that is incredibly critical. Beyond just the interactions, though, there are lots of circumstances that we really as designers often don't pay attention to. I almost got into a wreck on the way to the meeting. I almost, I had a phone call with some tragic news or some great news right prior to that. What am I thinking about during the interaction? Do I have an acumen for what I'm trying to accomplish? Have I used the software before? Have I used this website before? All of those things are, I think, critical to take into consideration when you're building and planning and designing for interaction. A lot of times, this is an example of a relatively simple interaction. It's a narrative that describes logging onto your computer. Relatively simple in terms of 15 quick steps. Most of us don't even think about it when we do it. Yet there's a tremendous amount of information involved in all of that process. And right here, really, I'm only considering the user, the technology, the environment, and the interface itself. I think there's more to be thinking about than just those simple things. It said I was a proponent of UCD. I'm also a proponent of usage, of goals, of activity theory. I think the human factors model is worth looking at. These are all pretty thin slices of that situation. I think one of the things we need to do is think beyond these sort of models. These are fairly simplistic, fairly low-dimensional sort of models for interaction. Larry Keeley says that you cannot get information from the consumer because they basically don't know it. They can't tell you what they don't know. If you buy into what Gerald Zaltman writes, 60 to 80% of what we think, what we do, how we react, how we act, is all unconscious. So asking direct questions in things like surveys and focus groups is pretty short-sighted and going to give you a fairly shallow understanding of what the user is all about. I like to plot things on a couple of continuums, one being how dedicated is the user. The accountant using their software is considerably more invested than the typical user coming to shop at a site. I think the number of times you use those interactions, the frequency, also impacts greatly how you deal with them. Software interactions, I've really bipolar sort of set these up, but software requires considerably more interaction, but probably less research. I think all in all, we don't know enough. I don't know that I've ever been in a situation where my design or my team's design has not benefited from knowing more about the user and about the circumstance. So I think the sponge metaphor works pretty well here. All in all, my point, I guess, to this group is we need to do more research. I think we need to do better research. I think the litany of surveys that we do is pretty poor. It's a terrible way to get information. Inquiry, ethnography, some of those techniques are much more suited for what we need to pull out, the depth of the information that we need to pull from the user. I also think rote process is a big mistake. I've been in a number of environments where they want to nail down process and replicate it time after time after time. And I don't think design is particularly appropriate for that sort of process. I like to think in terms of structures. I like to have a variety of tools available, and I like to use them specifically for the problem as it's defined. I think designers also tend to hang out with other designers. A lot of fun, very comfortable, but not much in terms of expanding your horizons. I think we need to be looking to cognitivists, to behavioralists. I think we need to think about anthropologists and some of their technologies that we can pull into the design process. And all of that leads us back to paying a lot more attention to the users and what their needs and what their wants are. That's me. Thanks for listening.
Give me a minute. I'm not a Mac user.
Let me help you.
Hey, it's an OS. It's not a religion, people.
Nope, that's yours.
No right, jihadists, not working please.
That's funny.
Hey, don't Mac users say they have a
Okay. I don't think anyone explained, but Robert asked us to do these Pecha Kucha presentations. Does anybody know what those are? You're supposed to do 20 slides, 20 seconds each. So we've put it on a timer, which is why Mark hesitated waiting for it to go, and I'm going to do the same thing. Whoops. See? It's on a timer. So I'm going to talk about not why we should ignore users, but how we should ignore users. As I said earlier, I'm short. I worked for 10 years in Australia building a business where we were given often only a couple of weeks to do our projects. So we did a very highly scalable version of user-centered design. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that and how that worked. So I'll talk about how we should ignore users. All right, so my animations aren't working on the Mac. anyway, so this will be an interesting test. What I think is we're not just designing for users, but there's a whole equation that you need to think about, which are people, activities, and situations. And often when usability doesn't work, it's because we forgot about the context of use. And then you also need to think about why you're designing something and what you're designing, if there's a business need or what. And you don't always want to ask users what they want. So I never watched The Simpsons, but I happened to catch this episode by divine providence. And this is where Homer bankrupts his cousin by building the car that he wants, and the cousin thinks it's going to be the perfect car for every average Joe in America, and finds out that by doing exactly what the user wanted, it's not going to work, and he gets bankrupted. You don't want to ask users what they want. They don't know. On the other hand, I'm just Jen Cheat. you want to design unexpected experience for people, and to do that, you also can't ask the users what they want. This is a garden in Kyoto, and it's about 400 years old, and they designed it so that they delivered a particular experience. If you walked along the path, there are little stones that you have to watch, so you have to look down while you're walking along, and when you get to the end, you look up, and you see this beautiful scenery, and that's the experience that they designed. And they weren't talking to users to get that experience, but it was a definite experience that they were trying to create. And I think we can do similar things to that, but you can't ask the users what they want in that sort of a situation. Also, as Mark pointed out, 60% of what people want is subconscious or emotional, so you can't ask for it. You have to find other ways to get that information. So a lot of things comes from subconscious knowledge, and asking people what they want isn't going to give that to you. Also, I think that the whole thing about personas is way overblown, and we spend way too much time trying to collect information about personas. When I was doing work, we usually had a day or two to find out about our users, and so we would just collect the information that we needed. Now, I have a unique experience that most of my work in Australia was in-house software development, not commercial software development. So we had access to our users, and we could look at the user as a part of a bigger puzzle. We could look at the user, the task, the platform, and then how that environment or context actually influenced all those different things. So, for example, activities just don't exist without people. So you have a person, like this person, Kat, who is a mother of two teenagers, and she's answering her emails, that's the activity, on her BlackBerry, which is the tool in the New York subway. So there's a whole bunch of things there you have to think about when you're designing the interface. You can't just think about what the user wants, because she's not going to know. You have to, as the designer, make sense of all of that. People aren't blank slates either, so they always come with a goal, a set of knowledge, an expected way to do something, a set of existing skills, and you've got to match that with the platform or the visual language that you're building with. So what are the tools that you're actually creating with? And you do that through observation, through collaborative design, through evaluation and refinement. And then, of course, our tools these days are much more frequently used in a lot of different situations. So you have to, again, think about the context of use, and not a single context of use. And you also need to think about direct and indirect users, not just who's hitting the keyboard, but who is receiving that information in some way. I think we often forget about the stakeholders and the indirect users. So how do you do that? How do you collect that information about people, activities, and context? And I do it by writing stories. I collect stories. I create stories based on what I find out. I make up my own stories when there are no users or the experience is brand new. And when you write a story, you're actually taking the first step in design, and you're designing the experience. And you can write several stories. My stories I call activity scenarios, which are narratives, which put a user in a particular situation with an objective. You outline the steps or tasks, you put the detail behind those actions, and you even write in the emotions you want them to have, but you don't write the interaction, and we would design several designs to support this particular experience as it's described in the story. So we write a story, you illustrate the story with sketches, with wireframes, with functional mock-ups, whatever. You tell the story, you get feedback on the story, and then you go on and write another story about another group of users doing different tasks in a different situation, and continually test the design that you're coming up with, either by walking through it yourself or walking through it with users. So sometimes stories are enough, and sometimes that's all you have because there isn't, you know, when you're designing a new application for something that never existed before, there are no users, there's nothing for you to base it on. So you have to make those things up. And again, you have to think about direct and indirect users and future users and things that don't exist, so there's no one to talk to yet. Here's a very quick and old case study that we did for Telstra, which is the big telecommunications company in Australia. We had to do this in 3 weeks. We already had some of the visual design from previous projects that we had done, so that gave us a little bit of a leg up. But we started by spending 2 mornings hanging out in shops where they sold their cell phones and watching customers buying their cell phones, and then we would very quickly talk to the salespeople afterwards. And then we would go back and start to put together our story using Post-it notes. So there's lots of different ways you can put a story together. We did outline one more like a narrative in order to walk through our illustrated scenarios later on. So you can capture your stories in different ways. And then because it was going to be activity-based, we did it from the perspective of the users. So as you can see, it says buy a phone, upgrade a handset, migrate to digital. This was 8 years ago. And so that's the perspective of the indirect user, which was the customer, who in fact is the more important user. Even though they're not touching the machine, they're the more important user. So we didn't talk to those people, but we designed for it. And then we came up with a functional mock-up that we could walk through and show people and walk through our stories and so show how it was going to work. And as you can see, it's from the perspective of the customer who we actually didn't talk to. I had the unique experience of buying a cell phone and getting it connected to the network and being the customer without them knowing I'd also been the designer, and that was interesting. So if a story doesn't work, try choreography. I just love this case study. It's from the Rockwell Group, an architect in New York, where he worked with a choreographer to sort of design the space in the TWA terminal and JFK to redesign it, thinking about how people flow through that space. And so this was just sort of to keep you awake and see if you're paying attention. Anyway, we should not ignore users, but you have to take them equally with activities and situations and the context in order to design a good experience. And thank you. I'm done.
All right. And again, I am Robert Hookman, Jr. I am taller than Sarah. And I am an interaction design consultant, formerly with GoDaddy.com, but now currently a full-time consultant. And I'm also the author of a book called Designing the Obvious. If you've heard of it, there's a book signing later on at 3 o'clock. I'm going to get rid of that presentation and proceed to disagree with almost everything that Mark said and only some of what Sarah said.
Okie dokie. Oh, Robert yeah. And I have been sparring for a few months.
I'm sorry?
I said we've been sparring for a few months.
We have. Me and Mark actually met on the interaction design discussion list where we have rather heated discussions very, very often. So at any rate, I'm going to tell you why we should ignore users. It's a shocking claim, of course, but it's very valid. I'm going to show you an example of success with a different approach. I'm going to show you some flaws with user research and a way of working without user research. First, here are 3 applications that were all designed within the same time period. They were all designed by one person, which was me. They were launched within 1 week of each other. So that means I was doing a whole lot of design work all at once. And 2 of these applications are fairly common, a forums app and an online photo organization tool. But they were all done without user research, which is something a user-centered designer would think is bad. All of them are surpassing sales expectations. They also require record low customer support. 2 months after all 3 of these applications have been released, the only customer support calls to come in were related to bugs. One of the problems with user-centered design, as I see it, is that business goals tend to be, you know, to get products out quickly and to also be very usable, but user-centered design processes are not quick. Software companies move very, very fast, and many of them still do not dedicate much time to design work, and besides this, there are a lot of problems with user research. Among those problems are that people commonly purchase things based on feature lists, as with the chart shown here, but actually want usability in the long run. Despite this, they often demand features that little do they know will make the app less usable in the long run. It's a quick sandwich story here. Fast food chain put out a low-carb version of their best-selling cheeseburger. They went out and asked a bunch of people, did user research, found out unanimously that everybody, of course, would buy the low-carb version of the cheeseburger. They put it out, and it failed miserably within a matter of a couple of weeks. When asked what several users liked most about the new version of a particular web application, one gentleman said, the new interface plain out rocks. It runs faster and it's much more intuitive. Thanks, guys. Keep up the good work. Another one said, all right, nothing. The old one worked just fine and it didn't look like dog vomit. Fire the idiot that came up with this piece of junk. Absolutely unusable. So that just goes to show you what can happen when you talk to users. So when the iPod was announced in 2002, a bunch of people on Mac Rumors complained that it was just another MP3 player. And in fact, one user actually said, the reality distortion field is starting to warp Steve's mind. If he thinks for 1 second this thing is going to take off. Anyone find a flaw with that? How many of you have iPods? Yeah, exactly. Part of the problem with talking to users is that a lot of users just simply may not know what's possible. They may not think that there's anything wrong with their current processes or methods for accomplishing activities. Users are not web application designers. Their job is not to understand the technology. Their job is not to know how to make those things better. Kathy Sierra herself, who did the opening remarks at South by Southwest, said, the more successful the product or service is, the stronger the pressure to give in to user requests. The more users you have, the more diverse the request. One user's must-have or else feature is another user's deal killer. So Kathy is somewhat in agreement with me here, which is always nice to have support from someone like that. So user research is supposed to be meant to narrow down the audience and to really figure out what types of users are going to be using your product. But some applications have a very, very wide range of user types. Designing for one audience can actually mean alienating others. User research aims at people most likely to use the application, but what about the audiences that you don't expect? Donald Norman proposes a slightly skewed approach called activity-centered design, in which he states that designing for an activity instead of a particular audience can actually abstract the product and its methodology and make it available to a wider range of audiences. Activity-centered design basically means forgetting about personas and scenarios, which is sort of what Sarah was saying. He argues that they don't genuinely help in guiding design work, and I completely agree with them. He said, did knowing that the persona is that of a 37-year-old single mother studying for the MBA at night really help lay out the control panel or determine the screen layout? Activity-centered design means forgetting about the notion that technology should adapt to people. People adapt to technology all the time. Clocks, cars, musical instruments, computers, things like that. We adapt to technology all the time. People change. People are moving targets, but activities are actually relatively stable. Our job is to make adapting easy, not to create adaptive technologies. Activity study can actually be done independently in a lot of cases, and one of the bright spots of it is that because you can do it independently, it tends to fit much better into speedy software design practices, such as agile environments. Does this mean that you should ignore users forever? No, not necessarily, just during the design projects. During the initial design phase, once you get something out, go ahead, listen. Listen in every way that you possibly can, but look for trends. Don't look for individual comments on blog posts or something like that. Look for major trends, much like you would find design patterns in design. There are also patterns in the way that people use computers. Those are the things you want to pay attention to. Do usability research on deep topics and unproven concepts and untested design patterns and things like that, but not on the individual applications. Again, much like design patterns in design, look for patterns in the people. There are certainly times when you should end up talking to users, and I think that is most appropriate when the activity that you're designing for is so far outside of your domain that you can't possibly handle it yourself, such as this guy. I'm not going to go design a cockpit of an F-14 without consulting a few expert pilots, because that's just not something I can do myself. So ultimately, the reason we should ignore users is because it's not our users' jobs to know what to do. It's ours. And because sticking to a vision and not bending to user demands as a product evolves means building better products. And because studying the activity instead of the audience decreases the time that you spend researching, which means you can start seeing a return on your investment more quickly, and sometimes it's all you have time to do. I'm Robert. Thank you.
So we'd like to open up the floor for questions. I'll ask a couple questions like as people head for the microphone, which I believe is down the center of the aisle.
Can we turn the lights up?
Yeah, let's get the lights up. That'd be nice. Somebody? Anyway.
You really want to turn the lights up on the poor hungover people?
No, we're ignoring you. I'm sorry. We're not going to put the lights on.
This is where they use their car.
Yes, absolutely. And as you hear people talk, or if somebody asks a really brilliant question or a really lame one, feel free to express your opinion via the red and green cards.
So it's interactive.
It's interactive, and it's user-centered. Oh, wacky. So before we head off to the audience, just really quickly, I'd like to ask a question, which is, how do you know you're right? You know, these panels tend to be sort of wild opinion fests. Do you have data sort of backing up your variety of choices?
Anybody want to jump in there? I just actually was talking about that in the presentation where I said basically we tracked, you know, our customer support calls. Very typically on applications, we would get a huge amount of customer support calls, as most companies would expect. Particularly with new applications, and one of the applications that I had pointed out there was actually to replace an existing application, completely replaced it with a completely new design, a wider scope, different purpose almost, and almost 2 months into the release of that product, there was not a single customer support call, and the two that I knew about that came in shortly thereafter were related to bugs, session timeouts, and things like that. They weren't related to, you know, how do I do X, Y, or Z.
So you're a fan of genius design.
I'm sorry?
So you're a fan of genius design.
Are you guys
You'd rather
with...
hire better and interview users less.
Yes. Interview users less and focus more on studying the activity itself with the knowledge of how users deal with computers.
And Mark, do you have any feelings?
Lots of them. I'm going to diverge from your question just a little bit and maybe chicken. More accurately, not chicken, better point. Address something that Robert said, which is letting users drive the product or innovation. And I'm absolutely not an advocate of that. I think one of the common problems that people have in looking at this step prior to design is twofold. First, people are really anxious to design, and I think that's great. But I think nice pause and looking around and bringing some of your audience into the process is great. Research and testing, two different things. Neither should direct the design. Both should inform design decisions. You know, the research isn't going to make the decisions. The designer has to be a half step ahead of the consumer or the user in almost every case.
So let's get a question from the audience.
Yes, my question is kind of deep with a little possible foresight into what the web is going to do. But it seems like a lot of what you guys are talking about is a single-focused design solution for what we would potentially think is our consumer. But I'm hoping that the web is going to go to a place where, let's say that through a profile or something like that, we can actually customize each experience for that potential consumer or segment or whatever we want to call it. So do you guys have any experience on, say, if I went to a website, created a profile, it's going to serve me something that is more targeted towards my interest as maybe a soccer mom would have a different experience? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Everyone's looking at me. That's funny. It's hard to tell from your question whether or not you're talking about software that sort of adapts to the user on an ongoing basis or just on a sort of a one-shot deal. A lot of that actually sort of exists in some web applications now where, you know, based on the sort of criteria that you enter during your registration process, you know, they can feed you different types of information. And certainly some things like Amazon, for example, there's an elaborate software piece going on in the back end there that creates your recommendations. It actually adapts to you in as you go along. But I think that's actually part of studying the activity. I think it's something that you would learn through that. You would learn that, you know,
the more you buy books, the more difficult it becomes to, or more redundant and monotonous it comes to, it becomes to go through them over and over again. And so it would be really great that to have a, some sort of recommendation engine. And I don't necessarily think you would have had to hunt down 10 people and ask them.
you'd have to know a lot about your users in order to do that.
It's true.
Right? So you'd have to do the research that you're arguing against.
It's interesting. I don't think you need to know a lot about the people that are using that particular application. I think you need to know a lot about how people deal with computers in general. Mm-hmm. Again, there are lots of trends in the way that people actually deal with computers. There's lots of things that you just see over and over again, regardless of what application or website they're dealing with. And part of studying the activity means sort of becoming a subject matter expert on that activity. And when you become a subject matter expert on the activity, you sort of become the user yourself. In which case, you can empathize with that base a lot more. And yes, that, we were actually talking about this last night. A lot of people would argue that user-centered design is basically nothing. It can be as little as simply thinking about the user as you design an application. And I would certainly advocate that. But the whole process of, you know, of going and finding a bunch of users in your target audience to talk to, and creating archetypal users to turn into personas and running them through these sort of use case scenarios and things like that. I think that's a tremendous time consumer, and I have yet to work for a software company where I actually have the time to do that. So
I just, can I respond,
yes,
to Robert?
Yes, please do.
So what's interesting is when we started our business in Australia in the early 90s, we had no time to do like detailed task design or anything like that, which is one reason we came up with these activity scenarios. Because you keep talking about how time-consuming user-centered design can be. I think getting deep into an activity and becoming the subject matter expert is also very time-consuming, and I never had time to do that either. And so we never did detailed task analysis. We used to wrangle and argue with traditional HCI people all the time because they'd say, you're not doing your task analysis. You're not spending a month doing X, Y, and Z. And I'd say, well, we don't have time. Our clients are only paying us for 3 weeks. We'll do what we can in 3 weeks. And we would write the stories and then rely on that stuff coming with time through the developers. We had to kind of trust them a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about if you scale back the extent of UCD processes and limit the amount of research that you do with users, how do you know that it ends up continues being effective?
Right. That's back to Christina's question.
Yeah. How do you know that you're right?
So I wouldn't mind briefly returning to the question the person asked. One thing that I did learn at Yahoo is that a lot of, and this actually speaks to the UCD thing too, is a lot of times we're conflict averse. We don't want to fight with the business folks. And what happens is we end up using user-centered design as a, I'm tired of fighting with you. I've been fighting with you for 3 days. Let's test it. As opposed to having the courage to follow through. And what's interesting about what the user said is I find personalization another crutch. 40% of my Yahoo users back when I worked there, and of course the numbers may have changed since then, made my Yahoo their homepage and did not personalize it at all. In other words, they took the defaults. If you didn't have the courage to do the research and do a very user-centered design, you would not have these people making it their homepage. But because they understood what a basic user would need, they made it work out of the gate, even without personalization, even though it was made to be personalized. And over again, when I see people argue back and forth, if they don't have time to do user-centered design, they'll just slap a personalization feature in there. And I think that we, as designers and as business people, have to have the courage to make a decision and move on sometimes. So there's another question?
Your thoughts on transitioning from an existing user interface to a new interface, or should you transition at all? Just flip a switch.
I keep wanting to hold one.
Are you talking about redesign versus rolling redesign?
Yes.
Were you asking any one of us in particular? Or?
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that, and how would you best?
Can you
best be done?
Yeah. The question was.
I mean, you just flip a switch and just from one day to the next, or.
So, Robert, should you just give the users what they want, or should you talk to them and ease them into it?
As far as redesign context go, you mean like, so take an existing application and then suddenly one day just randomly change it?
Exactly.
You know, like, don't warn anyone? I believe that with existing products, I mean, it's always going to be an issue regardless of what process you're latching onto. With existing products, I think, you know, you can still actually move into an activity-centered design approach and come up with a stronger vision for that product and then start working your way there incrementally.
I don't necessarily believe in doing, you know, the major redesign. I believe the major redesign has or should at least die. I believe in doing things, you know, very, very incrementally. So, you know, make a small change here, make a small change there, and do it gradually enough that you can get the product back into the shape that you want it in. Granted, this would be much more difficult with desktop applications. So sometimes those will be more significant changes. But yeah, I do believe that you can still switch gears after the product has been released and sort of shift into this new mindset.
I think that there are existing paradigms that people are fairly comfortable with but are still broken. We've become used to doing things certain ways that are still counterproductive. I think when you make that transfer, if you innovate, make a process better, there's a certain amount of education and adjustment that you're going to have to suffer through. There are lots of ways to help users manage that process. You can do it, as Robert said, incrementally. I think you can do it with helpers. You can do a lot of things to assist. But I think you have to think about where you're taking the user and what you're trying to accomplish. If you can provide them a richer experience, it's probably worth it.
It's also actually a great opportunity. Sorry. It's a great opportunity, I think, for good customer service. Because if you design for the change process, where instead of just, you know, dropping a brand new design on a bunch of users, suddenly, you know, you let them know ahead of time that you're going to be making some changes. Let them know what the changes are so that they're somewhat prepared for it. The people that are more resistant to change will expect it. They'll be less surprised when it happens. The people that are excited about change in their software are going to be really happy, and they're going to have something to look forward to. So you've enabled your users to be more passionate about your product. Managing that change process has a lot to do with it as well. So let them know ahead of time. Let them know, you know, give them an opportunity to continue using the old version for a while. Things like that to sort of ease everyone into the new design and help them feel comfortable along the way. I think it's a good opportunity for good customer service.
Well, and I've done a lot of in-house software design where you're designing software for a different business. You're not selling your software. And so radical changes often happen in those scenarios. Is anybody here doing in-house software design? About 10. But there, sometimes you have no choice but to do something like that. And if you can bring anything from the old system into the new system where people have existing knowledge, then you can ease them into that a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. But again, it's all about the change management, engaging some of those people in the design process. It's another argument for user-centered design, because by involving people, that's part of the change management process, and it's a good way to go.
Yeah, and a lot of what I talk about actually is it's not that I'm saying that you should just ignore users because they're idiots and they don't know what they're doing. It's not like that at all. It's quite the opposite. I care so much about making the user experience good for my customers that I've come to the realization the only way that I can do that is to stop listening to them and simply design something based on an intelligent approach and to study the activity and to, because what one user wants will be exactly the opposite of what other users want. And you're going to run into this problem over and over again. And so it's just a matter of, you know, of trusting my own expertise and trusting the information that I know and being able to, and basically the goal is to come up with something that is better than what they would have ever expected had I spent 2 months or even 2 days talking to them.
So I'd like to bring up another sacred cow, which is personas. There's been a lot of talk about personas being Barbies for designers.
How many people feel this way about personas?
Like, are personas valuable? If you think they're valuable, raise your green card. If you think they're worthless, raise your red.
Yeah. Okay. People who don't like personas, red. People who do like personas, green.
Could somebody who feels like personas saved their project go over to the mic and say why it was so awesome? And while we're waiting for somebody to have the courage.
I saw two green cards.
Yeah, there was like two green cards.
Well, then they're ballsy people. They're going to head for the microphone.
So I'm wondering did all of you guys come to the session this morning, like finally looking for an excuse to just call it a day?
Give up on personas?
All right. I'm really just going to speak hypothetically, but if you do a quick and dirty persona, not spend 3 weeks building it, but you've already known some things about your users. If you just have one hanging on the wall, you're having a meeting with some people from, say, marketing, and they come up with an idea, and they say, well, that won't really help John Q over here. then they would go over and look, oh, yeah, maybe you're right. So
I totally agree with that approach. The user profile idea that we worked with since about 1989 was very powerful because we had a name of somebody and we had an idea like, his name's Mark, he's a novice customer service rep, he's been with the company for 6 months, you know, he's sort of struggling a little bit, and that's it. We didn't know what kind of car he had, where he lived, if he had children, none of those things. That's, we didn't need to know anything more than that, and then it works really well.
So what, give me just 1 sec. So what if you do have one of those products that has a really wide range of users, and you can't necessarily narrow it down to 2 or 3 types, because it needs to work just as well for the 13-year-old tech geek down the street to the 87-year-old farmer in Kansas, you know, what do you do in that situation?
Does that really
pick
exist?
An audience.
Does that really exist?
I mean, granted, all of them have computers. For example, I used to work at GoDaddy.com. Can you think of a single user type that is going to buy a... I mean, granted, you've already narrowed the field by the fact that they have a computer, they want a website. That certainly narrows the field down. But buying a domain, anybody can do that. Anybody can do anything online.
Well, I got to say, I think that's disingenuous. I mean, I think anybody who's going to buy a domain is already, you know,
self-selected
in this room. But I got to say, web search is a perfect example. Like, basically, everybody, literally from the grandma with her 5-year-old laptop that she got from her kid, uses that. And look at the design that resulted. One box, one button. So, I got to, and you can't use personas for it. You can't use anything for it. But I think GoDaddy probably could use 2 or 3 personas.
Let him speak.
Yeah, let
for the record, I worked on web applications, not the website.
I just want to say this is exactly the kind of panel why I come to South by Southwest. Very provocative. I think the subtitle for this panel could have been throwing out the baby with the bathwater. and I guess my question is, why haven't you fired the researchers you've been working with previously who apparently are not doing a very good job? I mean, when I think about research, I don't think about asking people what they want, because I agree, people don't necessarily know. When I think about personas, I don't think about demographics and how old they are. I think about fundamental activities and goals and behaviors, things that from activity-based design we should be thinking about. Mm-hmm. My question is, why are we throwing out the baby with the bathwater? Why are we not reinventing what personas are, making them much more behavioral and activity-based, and less about who cares if she's 44 years old? You know, that becomes irrelevant. Mm-hmm. In light of what she actually wants to do and how she wants to do it. I mean, we're in this room, we're used to thinking in the shoes of our users, and we're accustomed to being able to design for that very quickly. But many people who do this for a living, who are designing user experiences, don't know how to do that well and need tools like personas to make who these people are that come to their website understandable and actionable within their organizations. And I hate to throw out the whole baby and bathwater together.
How do personas make your design work actionable? How, like, what is actionable about a persona?
Well, but specifically, I think that's the hard part. And what you're asking is something very difficult to do. It's easy to put together archetypes that we can all laugh at or we can all embrace or that sort of thing. It's an emotional tie-in. It pulls the team together, makes consultants good money. It's all good, right? But how do you translate that into really quality design? And I think that's the $60 million question is, that's really hard. How do you infer design decisions from something as static as a persona?
You can't. Exactly right. I mean, what I would respond to that is that what personas enable you to do is create the activity scenarios that we saw earlier grounded in reality now. So you've got stories.
You don't
have just these archetypal people that are stale and unmoving. You've got actual stories, scenarios that drive out tasks and use cases and features and how things should work. So it's all connected.
The persona is just a short step on the way to what you're actually trying to accomplish.
It is one step. Yeah, it's one step.
But I think it's a mini poll. Real quick question. Who here thinks that the only thing wrong with user-centered design is consultants?
We'll call it consultant-centered design.
Go on, Sarah.
I just quickly want to respond and say maybe what we need to think about is what our job is. In other words, we keep hearing a lot about don't do what users tell you. I mean, I always saw my job as interpreting what I heard and saw and making sense out of it. That's my job as a designer, not to do what users tell me to do, and not to take, you know, I've taught a lot of courses, and I always say to people, your users are not your designers. You are the designer. It's your job to interpret what you see and hear, because a lot of times somebody will say one thing. Thank you for the green card. People will say one thing and do something else, and you need to make sense out of what that means. And that's our job as designers. So you don't take a persona and a set of requests and say, there's our design, that's user-centered design. That's bullshit, as we say in Australia. You just don't do that.
We have the same
saying here. They say
here.
That here, too.
I know, but we say it out loud and on the radio in Australia.
It's global.
Yeah. So, we only have 10 minutes, so let's get some more audience questions out there.
Okay.
And no, by the way, for this session, nobody's allowed to say, this isn't a question, this is really more of a comment. No.
Well, this is a question. Okay, so we've been talking a lot about personas, but when we talk about activity-centered design and activity theory basically says that all interaction is socially is in a social context. And within activity theory, you talk about you have the person who is doing an activity, you have their social context, you have the role they play in that social context, you have the tools they use. All of this is something that should be captured in a persona, isn't it? I mean, if we're going to argue for activity-centered design and for activity theory as a basis for design, don't we have to say that, you know, in almost by definition, activity theory says we have to do personas?
Because activities don't exist without people.
Exactly.
Nice point.
But, yeah, that's a great point. But at the same time, you know, if we abstract the personas and try to turn them into something else and try to turn them into activity-focused personas, you're getting into marketing territory, and Mark would actually know a lot more about that than I would because he actually has some marketing background.
My understanding of from reading the literature is that personas actually stem from marketing.
Yeah, definitely. They're very similar. They might call them something else in marketing, but yeah.
So as a mini problem statement, really quickly, I'd like to ask each of the three of you to respond to this thing. So you go in, you meet a client, you have a three-hour meeting, and they spend the first hour telling you the life story of these three personas. And when you say, okay, what problem are you trying to solve for them? They don't know. They don't even know why they did the persona. What would you
Perfect client.
What would you do next? What would your next step be? In one sentence, each of you.
I wouldn't start with personas.
Haven't what?
I wouldn't start with... I wouldn't,
nope.
I wouldn't start with
personas. But you walk in. They've already got personas because they read that was a good idea in somebody's book, apparently not Robert's.
I wouldn't trust anything the client gave me. I would try to validate it. And I think defining the problem is about 60 to 70% of the whole issue.
So you would redo the personas?
I would put the personas... I would be very similar to Mark. I put the personas aside, and I would ask about the problem first, and then I would go back.
Okay, and Robert?
I completely agree with what Sarah just said. I would definitely, you know, I would nod my head and smile and say, okay, great, thanks, but I'm going to try to look at it at this different angle and
you're
engage
create
in a
persona?
Conversation about what's that?
And you're going to make your own personas?
No.
I've had to do that with use cases over and over and over again. Thank you for these use cases, Funk. I'm going to go do this over here.
Okay. Yeah, and I would try to engage the conversation and bring it back to what the product is really about and then start setting it from that angle.
So back to the audience.
Hi, my name is Andy and I use personas.
The first step is admitting you have a problem, Andy.
Well, what I do, whether it's based on talking to users or my assumptions about users, I use personas to embody and communicate what I know or think I know about my users. And if I need to, I can come up with something in just a couple hours. If I have the luxury of actually doing some real user research, I'll do that. And I need to communicate that. I work with a whole bunch of stakeholders who have very different conceptions of who I should be designing for and what our product is going to be used for. And it's a way for me to get consensus on what exactly we're doing before I've expended a lot of time and energy in going down a dead end.
Awesome. Thank you, Andy. Should we move on to the next question? Unless anybody
actually,
wants
I just had a quick comment about that.
We can move on.
Notice that he said the luxury of user research. Uh-huh. It's because you work at a software company, am I correct?
Uh,
Maybe. Oh, okay.
Robert, you always have to do your homework.
In-house guy.
Right, okay. So companies, again, don't typically devote a lot of time to design work. They hire outside consultancies on occasion to do things like that.
No, not always, but...
Software companies, I mean, anytime you're working on a web application, the interest of being agile and getting things out quickly and getting a return on that means that you either have to somehow make your, in my opinion, your user research less effective by scaling it and trying to adapt it into that process, or it means trying to come up with a new approach entirely.
Was that a capital A or a lowercase a?
Sorry, that's a whole side discussion.
Hi, I'm a designer, capital D. I'm not a human factors person. So my problem with UCA in particular, and to a degree with these other methods, is where they fall in the process. And what I've tried to do over the years is really put design at the front before a project's funded, before it's approved, so you don't end up with cases where we only have 3 weeks, so we can't do things. What I've found is it gets very muddy when you move these processes to the front, and they start to overlap with innovation methods, things like outcome-driven innovation, other things like that, and it starts to blur the focus of the group. And I was just wondering if you could comment on that.
I'm going to show a little bit of empathy for Robert's position here. I think it's, in a project-by-project basis, it's incredibly hard to gear up for research. You've got to react very, very quickly to the marketplace. And most business structures don't allow you the affordance of a lot of time to do research because they want, most companies, most managers, it's a CAB sort of imperative that they want to see action right now. I think it's for groups that are on iterative releases, ongoing initiatives, I think it's important. I think it's, in fact, crucial to have ongoing research, personas, task analysis, activity sort of structures that are constantly updated all of the time so that you can draw from those relatively quickly. I know it's expensive, but it's something you've got to do in order to do make better decisions in the design process.
Can I ask you a question? When you say you bring in the design for earlier in the process, what do you mean? Because I did something similar with my company. What we did was hire designers and teach them about usability and user-centered design. We didn't hire usability people. Eventually we did, but initially we did not, because we wanted to be a design company. And we brought the design process early, but it meant getting business analysts and people like that who like detail to think fuzzy for a while and trust it, right?
That's pretty much along the lines of what I'm talking about. We do a lot more design research, design strategy up front, so that, you know, instead of decisions being made based on what's valuable to the company, we try to bring equal footing to what's desirable to the customers. So balancing what's desirable, what's feasible from a technology point of view, and what's valuable. And there's no reason why what's desirable shouldn't play, you know, second fiddle to, you know, what's feasible and what's valuable.
And I found my activity scenarios were a good way to communicate that experience that I wanted people to have. And as I said, we didn't call it experience design, but we were doing this in the early 90s, and it was a way to communicate back to our, you know, customers in the telcos, in the banks and places like that, what the design could be. And then you start deriving your detail, your use cases, your objects, whatever you were doing at the time, you know, the method of that year.
And did those drive business decisions?
Once we earned the trust of our clients, yes. Because as consultants, we'd have to do it several times. And I remember one client saying to me, we just had to take a leap of faith. We didn't get what you were doing, but they would see the results. Going back to one of your earlier questions, Christina, we would see they would see the results, and then they'd say, we see that this works. But you have to get them to think big picture and fuzzy and bring it into focus over time, which is not the way software development methodologies normally work.
So shortly before I went to be an entrepreneur, I actually was the evil creature called a management consultant for a couple of years, trying to design management the way you design websites. And one of the things I noticed is everybody's cheap. Everybody wants to say, oh, design isn't happening until here, so let's not put the designer in until here. And what we simply did was we showed them that if it's not just design. The engineers are going, you're bringing me in too late. I can't help you think of new solutions. The usability and user research are saying, you're bringing me in too late. Everybody's saying, you're bringing me in too late. So what happens is if you make a really short cycle with a small, dedicated team that works from the beginning till the end together, you actually can save money and save time because you get more effective, cheaper solutions. And you go like mad, dirt cheap for a couple weeks, and bang, at the end, you have something awesome. As opposed to hand over to designer. Designer says, well, actually, that's not going to work. Hand back to the researcher. Does the researcher think the users are going to put up with that design change? Hand back to the designer. Designer changes that. Hand to the engineer. Engineer goes, what the hell have you just designed? Hands back to the designer. Designer hands back to, I mean, you can see very easily why saving time ends up making something 8 times longer. And that's a really good argument if you want to go back and say, hey, dude, let me sit down on these meetings, you know? It's really not about design being there in the beginning. It's about the designer being there in the beginning. Well, don't be afraid to represent yourself.
Mm-hmm. Everyone's looking through their own periscope as well. So you're sort of, different things are getting a different focus because everyone has their own perspective. If you create that design team and get everybody involved early, then you get all those different perspectives working together.
But don't forget the magic words. It's cheaper and it's faster.
There's a terrible risk, though, when you're doing that, of running into situations where everybody has a seat at the table on what you're trying to achieve there as a consensus, as opposed to expert collaboration. Yeah, you need a small team, and you need to, yeah, exactly.
You need to have one person that will make the final decision.
Exactly.
So I call it collaboration without consensus.
You need somebody who can make the call. Get ideas from everyone. Sure, definitely. Everybody's smart. Everybody's got good ideas. That's why you're working with them, right? But somebody's going to make the call in the end, so be wary of that. Yes?
I'm hoping I remember my literature classes correctly, but I believe it was in Crime and Punishment where one of the main themes they talk about is this notion that there are people who are so intelligent, talented, etc., that they are above the law. And so if we take that to design, and we can say, think that there are designers who are so intelligent and they can really get in touch with their users that they can sidestep all these processes and still put out great design. But then the state of the web and software would also tell us there are probably a lot of people who think that they fall in that category and clearly don't. So the question is, how do you know when you're that designer?
So because we've reached the end of our time,
when you can prove it.
Everybody who agrees they are that designer, stand up now and cheer. Oh, you're all too humble.
Wow.
Well, that's it.
Any other time they'd have the green cards up.
Sorry, sorry, we can't answer your question. Oh, there's a yellow card.
We thought we took those all out. I am that designer.
How do you know you're that?
But that was I think that was an awesome quote.
I think the simple answer to that is when you can prove it. When you've got facts to back it up. If you can be Steve Jobs, then be Steve Jobs. But obviously you have to be able to back it up with some actual metrics that say you've definitely succeeded. Thank you all for coming. Enjoy the rest of South by Southwest.